Lend Me Your Ears, the Oral Dramaturgies Podcast. The Gallery, interviews with artists.
Hello and welcome to The Gallery. In this episode, unusually, we focus on a particular show rather than an individual artist or company's body of work. The show is Misty, a mix of grime, autobiography, and abstract visual theatre, written by playwright and actor Arinze Kene, and directed by former associate director at the Bush Theatre in London, Omar Elarian. As we find out in the interview that follows, Misty was a labour of love and took some time to emerge, but it was special in many ways, not least in that it led to two Olivier nominations in 2019 for Best Play and Best Actor, after being only the second play of all time by a black playwright to transfer to the West End. Arinze Kene also made an exception for Misty, his fifth full-length play, and personally acted in it. Following the usual gallery format, we work with our guests, Arinze Kene and Omar Elarian, to retrace their footsteps as artists, looking to examine where and how their individual creative paths intersected in making this extraordinary piece of gig theatre. This conversation took place on Zoom on the 3rd of July, 2020.
So, hi! Thank you so much for coming into this project and offering your time. So, yeah, Misty was quite a breath of fresh air. It came about in 2018 at the Bush Theatre in London, and then took the world by storm, went into the West End, and so on. I'm really interested, as part of this conversation, to unpack how that happened, how that phenomenon came about. And specifically, I'd be interested to take you back individually, possibly the first memories you might have around how you decided you wanted to make a theatre and be a theatre maker. What was it in your formative years that led you down this particular path? And what we have here are two very different journeys that met at a particular point in time. Shall we start with you, Arinze?
Sure.
You were born in Nigeria.
Yeah, so I came to London in 91. Winter 91, and I've been pretty much living in East London ever since. We came straight to Hackney. That was the beginning of my journey in England anyway. Music has always been a part of my life. I fell in love with Fela Kuti as a very young man. And so I think that opened the doors for things like performing. I feel like I've always been a bit of a performer.
Your first love was music, and then theatre came after. From what I can see in your biography, your sort of big break was The Lion King. You're playing Simba in The Lion King. But how did you get to that point? Did you train as a performer, or what was the journey to that point?
I didn't train. I'm from a very traditional Nigerian family, and my parents, they wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer or an accountant. I was at sixth form, and I was studying chemistry and biology, and I've always been very academic, and I've always had this kind of healthy balance between, I guess, academia and sport. You know, I've always played basketball, done athletics, and studied well. I was in school, and I just got a bit fed up, actually. I wasn't doing what I wanted to do. And so rather than go straight to university, I was going to go and study physiotherapy in the end. I took a gap year. And on this gap year, I said to myself that I was going to give myself a proper chance, a go at it, you know, because up to that point, I had been creating work in the margins. I was using my Saturday afternoon to go to this performing arts kind of club and do that and this, and but I'd never actually devoted my time. And so after my last exam, I became a runner for a sound company, 750 MPH, which is on Golden Square. And I guess being a runner there, getting lunch and coffees for like Ian McKellen and David Harewood was my kind of introduction into like being in the same room as some performers who I just saw on telly last night, who were great and brilliant. And hearing them, you know, do voiceovers for these adverts or do ADR. I think that made me really, really hungry. I was salivating on a daily basis because if I was now what I felt was in the middle of this thing, just not playing the role that I wanted to play within it, that's all. A few months after, I got an opportunity to play a lead role in a play called Torn at the Arcola. And so that was how I got my first agent. And then my agent didn't know I could sing, but in Torn, there was a little song in there, you know, a little kind of moment where he sings like a, not even a verse, you know. And my agent came to see it and was like, you didn't tell me you could sing. And I was like, yeah, I'll sing a little bit, whatever. I didn't really want to do musicals. I wanted to act in plays and do TV and film. And I don't think at that point I was really up for writing. I started going up for some stuff that involved a bit of music and full-blown musicals like The Lion King. And literally fast forward 4 months and I'm in auditions doing pirouettes and falling on my knees and crashing, like just crashing around the room while people were like, look at this bull. And I remember my first round of audition for The Lion King. I was learning on my feet. I was really quite learning on the job. And that was a cool experience. Pip Alien, who casts pretty much like nearly all, like a lot of the musicals in the West End, you know, she taught me how to audition properly. She's the one who taught me, because in the room, she would stop the audition and say, okay, Renzo, eye contact. There are people in the room, use us. And things like that, because I didn't go to drama school, you know, and you get taught some of this stuff a little bit, how to do an audition and so on, but it's completely different when you go into the audition and there's 15 people and there's the Americans and they're like all got their, at that time it was Blackberries, you know, and it's kind of like, you're just like, wait, I remember that I have to look at someone, but what about when there are 15 people? Who do you look at? I don't know, that job, da-da-da. Yeah, that's how The Lion King came about anyway. The first time around, I got down to the finals and I didn't get it. And then I did another job. And then this, when it came around again, I didn't have to go through the whole process because of Pippa knew who I, well, she had already gone through it with me. And so I just came in for the finals. And then I went off and did it. That was a great experience because I realized that kind of musical wasn't for me because of while I love watching musicals, I mean, Wicked is, I watch that a trillion times and Lion King, I think, is one of the best musicals, you know, but I didn't have any kind of creative input in the role of Simba. I kind of get dropped into that role and you hit the notes and you hit your mark on stage, you know, and you do those three, the triple pirouette and you stop at that time and everything is done. I felt a bit restricted. And that actually was when I started writing. It was actually from there.
What age were you when you landed that part of Simba? Do you remember how old were you at the time?
I was 20 and I turned 21 on that job.
You started writing as a result of feeling you wanted to write parts for yourself. Or were you writing, was the early writing not actually for the stage?
The first thing I wrote was a 10-page scene to get onto the critical mass group at the Royal Court, right? See, I knew I wanted to write before I even started writing plays. You know, I just wanted to get onto the course and I saw that they were taking, you could send in a full play or you could send in like any, you know, 10 pages at least. And so right at the deadline, I deliver these 10 pages and I get on the course. And yes, the initial goal was to create some opportunities for me. There were some parts that I wanted to play that I wasn't being given the opportunity to play, nor had I believed at the time that they were written. And so I was writing them. But the first play I wrote, Estate Walls, it proved to me that writing was way more than something I could use to expedite my career. Like, you know, it was more than that. It could be more than that if I let it, you know, if I get my ego out of the way and I just write. After the first draft, I realized that the play, I'm not in it. And as well, we did a reading and I was like, oh God, this is, I just didn't know that all these actors could bring all of these things to the reading. And I remember the first reading of it, like it was just, it just had some great actors, you know, reading. It was Ricky McLeod, it was Daniel Kaluuya, Alex Lanipekin, Kingsley Benadir, Zowie Ashton. And they came and they read the hell out of my script. Right? And I was like, man, these guys are fire. Like, you know? and yeah, there's nothing like that, you know, that experience to make you kind of go, okay, cool. Like, you know, I need to humble myself and not like try and just be like, yo, hey, I'm an actor. That's what it felt like. But the first draft, it was all kind of for me, you know, and then after that, I felt much freer as well when I knew I wasn't writing for myself. between when I started writing and when Misty got on, that was 11 years. And all that time, I hadn't written something for myself.
Wow. So you wrote plays in a sort of royal court sense of the word. That was something that was your starting point. And then Misty had a completely different form. It was spoken word and episodic and for you, right? Mm. Was there a particular trajectory in your development as an artist that then resulted in Misty as that form, as a form that wasn't a royal court type of play? It's built as spoken word and gig theatre. So what I'm looking for is, had you been writing poetry before that actually maybe led to this particular form?
Yes, I had. In my teens, when I was in sixth form, when I was studying chemistry and biology, I was in two bands. I was in a band called Yoka, which means listen. And I was also in a band called JH Collective, Jazz Hop Collective. And I was, I was the vocalist in these two bands, and we were going around the country and making music and performing. And so I was always writing, you know, I was always working with musicians, and yeah, it was fun. And even before then, I was writing rhymes, I was rapping, and I dropped these two mixtapes. I dropped a mixtape called Let's Go, and then I dropped one called Strictly Unrelated. And then acting started taking off, you see, and writing plays, you know, I was getting them on. And I don't know what it was, why I separated them, but I did that early on. I think it's because of that influence of, at the time, the things I was exposed to. For a very long time, my favorite playwright was Sam Shepard, right? He's still one of my favorite playwrights. You know, I was like, oh man, this is how you write play. And then I'm reading works of like Tracy Letts, you know, and I'm like, yeah, fuck, this is how you write play, you know. And then, you know, you see some August Wilson and you just develop your palette and you're seeing stuff. And then you see more devised work and you go, whoa, what just happened? Like, I'd see work and I'd just be like, how does it look on the page? Like, I don't understand how this will look, you know. I've always played with structure. With the first play, Estate Walls, the prologue, it's a song kind of thing. I'm on the estate wall, me too. I'm on and it's like a minute long, and it's kind of like different characters saying different lines and it rhymes, you know. And then we have a play, and the play is like act one, act two, act three. And then, you know, Little Baby Jesus, there are like musical kind of moments in there. There's the very end, the epilogue of the play is musical. Again, you know, it's kind of like a similar kind of line. I say, da-da, but don't forget to da-da, da-da, but don't forget to da-da, da-da. And yeah, God's Property didn't really have that at all. But I feel like I was always just playing with the idea. I was toying with bringing music into it, but I wasn't brave enough. And then I feel like a few things happened in a row. One of them was having a very bad experience in television as a writer, or two very bad experiences back to back. And then one really tough experience while writing a film. And all of them, me feeling like I wasn't understood, or like I was misunderstood as a creator. And then seeing the right work at the right time, like seeing Omar's, he directed You're Not Like the Other Girls, Chrissy, the Caroline Horton play, going to Berlin and seeing some very incredible work at the Schaubrunner, and going back in time, like discovering Charlie Chaplin, you know, like and looking at him as a performer and creator and recurring character, and allowing these things, allowing myself to just like surrender and just kind of go like, what is it that about all of this that you really love? And then, yeah, not throwing away the lessons that I learned from the court and from writing God's Property and from like loving a traditional play, but actually letting it be a part of what I'm doing from now on, you know, and not like, I guess, shunning the world of TV and the development hell and things getting greenlit and then going into turnaround, but actually going like, how can this inform me? How can this inform what I do? And I just let it in.
I'm also interested in the way in which you both come from very interesting cultural backgrounds that are kind of combined, you know, combined influences of different cultures. So in your case, Orinze, you were born in Nigeria. You were about 4 or 5 when you came to the UK. Omar, can you tell us about your background and what was your journey?
Sorry, my life is a bit more convoluted. Yeah. So my father is Palestinian. although he was born in Egypt, because he was born in 1950. My grandparents used to live in Jaffa, which is now the state of Israel. So in 1948, they had to leave. They became exiles and refugees, and they moved to Egypt first, and then Kuwait, and then back to Egypt. And eventually the family kind of spread out in different directions in the US. And my dad, after studying in Cairo in the 70s, then moved to Italy, bit on a whim. Mm-hmm. At the time, Italy was quite welcoming of Palestinians. So I think he got a scholarship to go and study something. And that was his kind of bridge to come in, and then settled in this tiny little town in the outskirts of Milan called Gorgonzola, which is where the cheese comes from. And he met my mom. So they got married. I was born 1978 in Milan. And then soon after, we moved to Kuwait, because that's where my dad's family was. And we stayed there for a few years until I was five. My brother was born there. And then we came back to Milan. My sister was born there in 1986. We moved to Cairo for a little while because my grandfather was very ill and he was passing away. My dad had to take care of family business at the time. Then the Gulf War happened in Kuwait. Most of my uncles and aunties had to leave and kind of flee to the US, Bolivia, like wherever they kind of could find asylum or refuge. We went to the US for a year when I was like 10 in Florida, because that's where my aunt was living. And then my mom said, like, enough. We're going back to Italy, back to Gorgonzola, where it all started. And they've been living there ever since. So I grew up a bit everywhere. And then from the age of 11, I was there, like, back in Gorgonzola, in this town in the suburbs of Milan. And when I was in high school, we don't do drama as a subject there. But you had this guy called Attilio, who was a kind of English teacher somewhere else, who was very passionate about theater. And he had studied a bit with people who were in the Grotowski companies, Peter Brook, Eugenio Barba. So all these kind of like 70s, more experimental theater companies. And he set up like a Saturday after school theater group. And I was completely uninterested in it. I was playing basketball. I don't come from a family that is particularly interested in theater or cinema. And what happened was, one day a friend of mine stole my backpack on a Saturday and hid it in the room where they were having the drama class. And they had started the drama class and school had finished. And I had to take my bus and I couldn't find my backpack. And I go, where the fuck did you put it? And then I kind of see the door. I see my friend inside. He's taking the drama class. So I knock and I say, I'm really sorry to disturb, but this dickhead stole my backpack and I need it. And Attilio, the teacher, said, like, well, now that you've interrupted, you can't leave. You have to stay. And I'm like, no, I really need to go. And he was so persuasive. And I was like, okay, I'll stay. You know, that's how it started. This was when I was 16, 17.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I think I did 2 years of these drama classes. And what he did, we were not studying drama. We were making stuff. He would make us write our own things. Everything was created in collaboration. We were doing these super wacky exercises. And of course, I mean, I didn't know it at the time. I discovered it later. And Attilio is still like a very, very dear friend and a guide, you know, in all that has to do with theater and life in general. But he was really somebody that was interested in breaking down the conventions and societal prescriptions that are ingrained in establishment structures like schools. So we were writing this stuff that, you know, was all about like suicidal tendencies and giving the middle finger to teachers and sex, like all sorts of stuff that at the time felt super taboo. And we, of course, were not discussing. And, you know, this is before social media, before the internet, really. So it felt like really an outlet to do something that felt both mischievous, but at the same time, really powerful, really liberating. In those 2 years, I met a lot of people that were in that group. Actually, my partner, the mother of my children, was in that same group.
Okay.
So after a couple of years of that, we then all went to university. I went to uni in Milan. And so a bunch of us created this, in Italy, you call it cultural associations, like a not-for-profit. It was maybe a dozen of us, and a lot of us knew of each other from this group. Some of them were musicians, some of them were more interested in film, some of them were more interested in writing, some of them were interested in acting. So a lot of our work was really a bit improvised. And I think that came from that group of like not trying to apply any sort of recipe or trying to imitate anything. And there was an old cinema in Melzo, this town just next door to Gorgonzola, which was part of a kind of old building in the center of town and used to be a theater before the war, was left abandoned. And it had like a massive room with 400 seats and a stage. And then it had a little studio, smaller screen room. And it was in the same courtyard as the public library. And we went to the town council and said, like, can we have it? And they gave it to us. So we kind of took ownership of this space, which was infested with rats and pigeons. And little by little, we just kind of refurbished it a bit and started running drama classes in schools. And it became a source of income. I was studying literature and philosophy at the University of Milan, and then kind of decided to specialize in theater and directing, although it was very theoretical. And we were doing shows, you know, we were doing our shows, organizing festivals, we were doing films, we got funding from the European Union to make films and short films and productions that then toured festivals. But it was all a bit like a bunch of friends doing the thing they loved, really. And then came the moment, I think, when we all graduated, we had this big meeting where we all sat down and went like, are we really going to spend the rest of our lives in Melzo and Gorgonzola doing this? And then we all looked at each other and go like, no, I want to do something. I want to see other places, you know? And quickly we dispersed. My best friend, who was part of the company, he went to Paris to study cinema in a school called ACAR. And a year later, after I graduated, I applied for Lecoq, a bit because I had read the book and I really loved it. It was, again, something that chimed very much with how I saw theater making at the time, which was all about experimenting different things and trying to kind of bring different influences together. And also I felt I really lacked the practical side of training. We were blessed to have a really good theater scene in Milan where all the big names came from abroad, Liv Dodin, Necrosius, Robert Lepage, Peter Brook, you know, Ariane Mouchkine. I could see all that for, you know, €5. But I didn't really ever have any kind of formal training. You know, we were just making it up as we were going. And so I applied. I didn't speak a word of French, and they accepted me, so I went. It was a marriage made in heaven with the pedagogy at Lecoq for me. You know, I don't think it works that way for everybody, but for me, for my sensibility and for probably also who I was and who I wanted to be at the time and what I needed in my life, it was really great because it's a place where I met people from all over the world, from different walks of life. We worked in a range of different languages. The influences were so disparate, from African theater to Japanese theater to Swedish, American, Canadian, South American. Like, it was a real melting pot.
How did you end up in the UK?
So I stayed then 6 extra years in Paris. And then I came to the UK in 2009. Actually, I did the show in 2008 for Daniel Goldman, who was running the CASA Latin American Theatre Festival. He used to be at Le Coq with me. And many of the people that were in my year at Le Coq were British and had come back to Britain. And I moved to the UK because my partner was studying here at the NFTS, and also because I was a bit fed up with living in Paris. So I moved to London. And the first thing I did was, Caroline had started working on a scratch of this show, which was her first solo show
about her grandmother.
Yeah, who was French and mm-hmm. came to mm-hmm. England before the war and fell in love with an English man, and then the war happened and they were separated, and then they...
We're just elaborating on this because Renzo also mentioned it as a piece that he loved, and I loved it too. I saw it three times. So,
So Daniel Goldman was attached to it originally, and then he was quite busy and I was around, and Caroline and I met, and she said, like, oh, would you like to work a bit on it while Daniel is not around? And at the time, it was just to create a 15-minute scratch for China Plate's Bite Size Festival. And then it kind of won the bursary that was offered there. And Daniel then had to leave the project, and we finished it. We created the one-hour show, took it to Edinburgh. I was still working a bit in Italy and France at the time on other shows. I remember sitting in the living room of our apartment in London, which was brand new and unfurnished, and it was a perfect space to have rehearsals with Caroline, and just going like, yeah, this is just a show that we're doing. And then it went on to have like a really brilliant life and an accolade. And so that was 2010. And around that time, actually, I met Madani. Mm-hmm. Eunice, who at the time was running Freedom Studios in Bradford. He offered me a job there to come on board as associate director for this big project that they were doing called the Mill City of Dreams, which was a kind of site-specific promenade show in a disused textile mill in Bradford. And we were working with a mixture of community cast and professional performers. And I had done a lot of that work in Italy, of course. So we created this crazy show. So it was an amazing opportunity to kind of discover a whole sliver of history that I wasn't aware of in terms of Bradford and Yorkshire and the Industrial Revolution there, the post-industrial revolution. And then after that, Madani was offered the job at the Bush, and he basically gave me a call and said, like, would you want to come on board and join me? And I was like, oh, the Bush, it's not my cup of tea, because up to then, really, new writing in that kind of more traditional way was never something I had considered doing, nor something that I would normally attend as a theater goer. And I found it always quite literal, like at the time, of course, coming from a more devising background, I was like, we're all theater makers. So, you know, either we all sit in the room together or I'm not really interested. But anyway, that kind of quite black and white then dissipated in the moment in which I think Madani convinced me that it was a great opportunity, because the Bush at the time was moving from the room above the pub onto the Shepherd's Bush Library, and there was really the opportunity to do something different and take this organization to write another chapter. And so I came in. We started in late 2011, and then I've stayed there for 7 years until Madani and I both left after we did Misty.
Here is the city that we live in. Notice that the city that we live in is alive. Analyze our city and you'll find that our city even has bodily features. Our city's organs function like any living creature. Our city is a living creature. A living, breathing city creature broken into boroughs. Mostly, living creatures are broken into organs. For the city creature, each borough is an organ. And if we're saying that the boroughs be the organs now, you might liken the borough that I live in to the bowel. So if the boroughs be the organs of our city creature, then our motorways are the arteries of city creatures. The high streets be arterioles of city creatures, and each road is a capillary. Furthermore, traveling down the blood vessels of our living city creature, night buses are packed with blood cells, red and white, them as the passengers, you and you. It's a normal night, some of you are light, more of you get on and pack it tight, but all is well, cause blood cell to blood cell, there's nothing to fear. But if you're wise enough, you know not all of us aboard this bus are blood cells. Nah, one of us is virus.
And so how should we now get to it, Misty?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So how did that encounter happen? How did you come onto each other's radars coming from such different directions?
Well, we did Chrissy in the opening season as part of a double bill with Sabrina Mahfouz, Dry Ice. So that first season was cobbled up quite quickly in a few months after we started. We brought in a few things that we had and we had seen at the Fringe, and also a few plays that we were developing. And of course, at the time, I think Madani had seen Little Baby Jesus at the Oval House. Was it Oval House or Inzer?
Edinburgh Fringe.
I hadn't seen it, but he gave it to me to read it. And Madani said, like, oh, we should definitely meet with, you should definitely meet Renze and we should commission him. And I said, like, yeah, sure.
And shall we hear a little bit about this piece then, maybe, since it was so influential? What was the form of Little Baby Jesus?
It was a triptych, and so it was a three-hander that was mostly delivered direct address, so it was mostly kind of like in monologue form, but you had these three performers all telling a story, like their own version of a story, and there was these three stories that kind of run concurrent, but they kind of overlap. It's a coming-of-age story for these three teenage inner-city kids. They all grow up in the same area, but they don't really know each other. And so as their stories kind of wash over, so this one kind of passes the laundrette, the other one's passing the laundrette, but on the other side of the street. And in the end, you know, there's like one scene in the whole script where the characters talk to each other. I wrote it for the Oval House Theatre, and then so it was on there, and then it went to, it did Latitude Festival, and it did Edinburgh.
Okay, listen up. You have 75 years to be all you can be.
I used to have mixed race girl syndrome. Mixed race girl syndrome is the long obsessive phase of a fancy mixed race girls. Oh my days! How is that only me though? Jerome said it before me even. Yeah, you wouldn't hear him though, would you? You've got selective hearing, you know that, sir.
After school, I hawk the 271 bus route for a couple of journeys to kill time before I touch the morbidity that is a place I'm forced to call my home. I've been searching
for you. I've got a really light-skinned girlfriend. Said if I couldn't be one, I'd have to represent one to compensate.
That was the one where in the epilogue, there was a bit of a rhythmic kind of musical thing to it as well. But it was still acoustic, you know, it was still a cappella.
Okay, great. On the basis of this encounter with Little Baby Jesus, you programmed the Rinze into the opening season of The Bush. Is that right?
No. We didn't program the show. Mm-hmm. We invited the Rinze in to offer him a commission. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, we needed to start a new slate of commissioned work from scratch. And, I mean, I don't know, Arinza, do you want to tell the story? Should I tell the story?
I mean, it's funny because what would be... I think they would be different. Because I've never heard you tell this story of bringing
okay.
you in. Go on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it was on a Saturday morning at the Bush Cafe. I think you had broken your Achilles heel playing...
Yep.
basketball.
Yeah.
And you had just been part of an R&D we were developing this play by Che Walker called Little Benny. And that's I think how you and I first kind of met in person. or have been in the same room. And then we invited Arinze in to basically offer him a commission. Just go like, we dig your work and what do you want to write? And I remember like Arinze kind of cracking, laughing and going like, oh man, it's great, but you know what they say about the bush? He's like, no, what did they say about the bush? He's like, well, that there hasn't been a black writer commission at the bush for ever. And Madani was like, oh, shut up. That's not true. That's not possible. And then, so anyway, we do the meeting. We offer him a commission. And then Madani and I remember go back in the office and like, oh, we should check this thing about the writers on commission at the bush before our time. And then I remember we asked like the literary assistant to kind of dig. We couldn't find a record of who was the last playwright of color that had the kind of active commission at the bush, you know? And it became, I mean, of course we weren't naive to what the landscape looked like at the time, but it was quite sobering to discover it and to hear it from Arinze's, you know, mouth at the time, that this was a kind of thing that was in the know, you know? But Arinze was the first writer we commissioned from scratch. Like we had already done that first season. So we had a couple of plays that we kind of picked up and produced, but he was the first one we said like, okay, we're going to start a journey with Arinze, offer him a commission, see what he wants to write and develop it to the end.
What was the development process?
It wasn't Misty.
Okay.
No, it was a different play at the beginning. So I think after that meeting was simply the invitation, I think, to come with an idea, but that the commission was there for the taking. And then, Rinza, you want to say a bit more about what that first project was?
I mean, it's such an interesting thing. I mean, I didn't know how important what I was researching at the time was. It's now kind of come back up in a weird way. But I stumbled upon some artists that I didn't know about from the Harlem Renaissance era. And I wanted to tell a story about that. And I tried to tell this story. And I still have back there in one of the notebooks, it's like filled with like sand, right? Because if I remember this is early 2014, I was in South Africa doing Our Girl, this series. And I was like, really like trying to make this thing work, right? We shot the like, whole thing on basically in these sandy areas. We was kind of shooting South Africa for Afghanistan. I was playing like a glorified extra somewhere, you know? So I had my notebook and like, you know, cut, and I took 10 minutes, 20 minutes to reset the scene and to get rid of the footprints in the sand. And so I was going to get shade and I was writing, working on this idea, and it just wasn't coming together. And so I remember coming back to the UK, I can't remember when exactly it was that I tried to pay back the commission, but I think it was in 2014, you know, at the end of 2014, right? And it wasn't right. And Madani refused to let me pay back the commission. I think what he said at the time was, I didn't commission a play, I commissioned you, right? Or, you know, like, you just take your time, whatever. And yeah, I realized that, yeah, that what I wasn't, you know, I needed to think about something new. You know, I kind of had to put that whole thing away. And so I put that idea away. Yeah, I guess Misty kind of, it was a thing that started coming, it started coming out. It started just developing because of things in my life that were developing, like as in moving back to Hackney, for example. So moving from Queen's Park, where I'd been living for a few years, back to Hackney, seeing how gentrified Hackney. I mean, my mum has always lived in Hackney. And so I, even though I was in Queen's Park and I was still kind of like in Finsbury Park as well, like, you know, I was still coming here regularly, but to come and move back to see the changes was always something I wanted to talk about, you know. And it wasn't a very dominant theme in the early drafts of Misty, but it was in there. Like, there was something in there, you know, and it was a thing that came out through our kind of workshops that Omar and I would do, and through like experimenting and looking at the story and what I was saying, you know, and what we were trying to deliver and to explore. Yeah, that's how we got to Misty.
And Omar, what was the kernel that you found and what Misty, what Arinze brought to you that would become Misty, that you kind of latched on to as a director? And a dramaturg. You kind of had a dramaturgical role in it, presumably, as well.
Well, we had... I think, to a certain extent, for much of the work I do as a director, there is an element of dramaturgy, although we had three dramaturgs on this show. I don't know. It's really interesting to try and understand exactly what that definition entails. I think... For me, there were two things happening. One was there was a very practical imperative, which was Arinze had come with a bit of the stuff that he had written. It was written on a Moleskine notepad. We read it out like at 9 a.m. in the kitchen at the Bush. With I remember his agent at the time, Faye, was there, and Madani, and I can't remember who the producer was, maybe Nazaro. Yeah, I mean, there was a bunch of the senior team. And there was something in there, but it wasn't a play, you know, it wasn't finished. It was handwritten. It was like a bunch of notes and ideas, and it was quite mercurial. And I think this was April, and we had the Radar Festival coming up in November where we could present work in progress. I remember I said to Madani, I said, like, well, you know, let's see, because we could go on a long journey with this, but we have the opportunity to do something. What if we go in a room for a couple of weeks and see what we come out with? And then we present in front of an audience for two nights, whatever, it might be half an hour, it might be 50 minutes, who knows? Let's see where it can go, because we didn't have a blueprint, or at least I didn't have a blueprint for what it could develop into. It was more about trying to be in a room and see what it could unlock. So that's what we did. I think we got like a couple of weeks in September. The music was already something that Arinze felt needed to be there. So it was already written, the kind of virus story, as we call it, was written in verse and was written to a beat that he already had in his head. And so for me at the time was just about facilitating those 2 weeks and going like, okay, let's see what comes out of these 2 weeks. And of course there was something that I was particularly interested in artistically, which was to work with Arinze because I'd seen him on stage and I'd read his work, but also the conversation we were having about theater and about the stuff that mattered for us in theater and who you do it for and how do you do it and form. I felt like I wanted to explore that. It felt like we were going for a language that didn't feel like traditional or like, oh, I need to note this script and, you know, put you on a good path. It felt like there was a space for a collaboration. That's how it started, really.
Yeah, I mean, just to add to that, like, you know, my experience of working with Omar is like, in fact, it's something just occurred to me just as you were talking, Omar, but the fact that a lot of directors don't get to, well, actors get to see how other actors process things, because we're often in a cast with a bunch of other actors and we see how he and she work and they work, and but directors don't get that many opportunities, you know, to go through like an entire project with another director. Working with Omar was my first time working with a director who was so experimental, so open, and also it was just the first time working with someone like Omar. I don't know, maybe there aren't actually that many directors like Omar, but hearing you, things that I did know about you before that I learned later, you know, about your journey to through making work from nothing, I think that is what it was, what was brand new to me. It felt like there was another writer in the room. That's a big energy. It's a big personality, it's a big energy in the piece, and it takes up a lot of space. As a writer, if you can kind of leave your ego at the door and not be too wedded to ideas, you know, not be, even as a performer, if you kind of come with nothing and you're just kind of open, and an energy like Omar's is definitely one that can really help a piece, you know? And with Misty, it's like, the truth is there was, I can't even see Misty as a different piece. And it's because of it, it's so much what we did in those workshops, in the room, and you know who you're writing for. I knew very early on who I was writing for to direct this play. I'm not writing this one to be directed by Rupert Gould or Dominic Cook or whatever. You know, I knew it was Omar. And so you, that influences you. As a performer, I'm a learner before everything. You know, I always kind of been open to to pushing the boundaries. The energy of Omar and all this experience that he had from the Coq and just like making work in Italy and for so long as well, because I mean, you know, he looks young, but he's an old man. Like, no, I'm kidding. No, he's been making work forever, you know, like, and so having that to kind of bounce off of, to learn from, to play with, right, was very good, man.
It's nothing but modern day colonization. Modern day colonization. I just want to wake the fuck up out of this nightmare. I feel powerless, it's like sleep paralysis. Can't you see what's going on? We're being ousted by these shiny shoe-wearing viruses. They up the rent and kick out the blood cell tenants. They're shutting down the youth clubs and youth centres to build a bar and grill with a garden terrace. It's enough to impel us to desperate measures. Let us wake up out of our night terrors. Let us stand united against the oppressors. Let us activate and organize vengeance. Let us bring back our sworn businesses. Let us kick them out of our premises. Then let us gather all of these aggressors and make them reside in the death trap housing. See how they like all the heat and howling. There's gonna be black smoke rising again, 'cause my people are done internalizing again. No, we don't wanna hear apologizing again. It's time to start penalizing. To high heaven we've been compromising. While they're down with Lucifer harmonizing. It's why no justice is materializing.
And what about the music? Omar just said that you were writing text to a beat and music was being written, and then all of this came together in the rehearsal. Obviously, you spoke to us earlier, Arinze, about how you had this experience of working in bands and so on, and starting to incorporate rhythmic writing into your playwriting. But presumably, Misty was a kind of experience of making something that went deeper into that territory of writing with music. So how did that collaboration happen, anticipating the musical aspect of this piece? Because obviously in the show, you also had the drama, you had other musicians. How was the actual music making woven into the playwriting and the theater making process?
I think the reason why I can never remake Misty and make it sound like Misty is because of when I wrote Misty, I couldn't. And in fact, it's only now that I'm learning how to like play instruments like a bass guitar, and next it's piano, because of it. It makes my job so much easier if I can play, even if it's just a little. If I can put a demo together, then that makes my job so much easier. Whereas with Misty, I couldn't do any of that. I didn't know where to start. And so what I was doing was I made melodies, but vocals on top of that. And that's how I did it until we brought musicians in. And then it was like music. And then even still, it's kind of like I haven't done any instrumentation. And so they had to play. I just had a melody that I knew worked. They'd bring their music, their influence into it, and then we'd make it better. You know, my melody would change and it'd grow. Here's why I think another reason why this collaboration, Omar and I, works really well, because of music. I started writing music, and when you are in bands, you write music at the same time that you're making it. Rehearsals was, we'd come in and I'd, you know, I'd find you just, it's a room and you're sitting around and I'd find a seat, you know, and I have a mic in my hand. I don't have any lyrics yet, but these guys are figuring out like a way to start a song, and then they're just jamming. They're jamming. I come up with some sort of thing that I'm saying, you know, whether it's like, keep my hands clean all the time. And I just can't say that. I say that again and again. You know, I keep my hands clean all the time. And before you know it, it's like, it's not I keep my hands clean, but it's like, if a child washes his hands, yeah, then he can eat with kings, you know, and it just grows. And that's how I made work. And so you have to be open to like that. And then if the bass guy, he's like, no, you know what, we should do this instead. And it's more of a kind of collaboration.
Yeah, and improvisation as well, by the sounds of things. Yes, yes. What you started saying at the beginning about how different working on The Lion King was to what you ended up with having in this process, it's really interesting to compare those experiences. So what was the actual journey from the Rada Festival on? Did you then have another version or did it grow? Or what would you say is the full length of the development process for Misty? Did it change in those different stages between the Rada Festival, the full run, and then the West End run?
Yeah, it did. I mean, Rada was 2015.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there was still 3 years of development. I mean, not that we've been working 24/7 on it for 3 years, because Arinza was very busy. And of course, everybody was busy. You know, we were kind of trying to get a week here, a week there. I think what the Rada Festival gave us at the time, where we presented roughly what could be a kind of bare bones version of the first act of the current Misty. So with no set and parts of the story, especially the meta structure, still very different. But roughly, you know, part of the music, part of the energy and the style were there. And we had a brilliant response from the people in the room. And so that gave us confirmation as producers at the Bush that there was something there. We had gotten along quite well in making those 50 minutes. So we really wanted to continue the work. And then because I think of the nature of the play, that was kind of sprawling. So it'd be fair to say, I think that in terms of the writing that was in verse, there was pretty much always a quite solid bit to start from. Parts of that have changed, have been refined, have been rewritten, but all in all, I would say that the bulk of it was there, the heart of it was there. All the stuff that was around it, what we used to call in workshops Misty Square. So this kind of meta structure.
Don't start that again. that was confusing.
Yeah. That was still up for grabs. We were discovering it as it went. And also, I think what was really interesting and what I think ended up affecting the final show, the final play, is that we were integrating within that, or Arinze mainly in his writing, but all of us in terms of the creative team, we were integrating what was happening to the play as we had performed it and as people gave feedback into that meta structure. So, I mean, I remember there was one point, I think you're asking, well, did you have conversations with people? And Arinze said like, oh yeah, this is what my sister said. And it was damning. And so what do we do with that? I was like, well, maybe we should put it in the show, but we can't put it in the show as straight. We need to find a way to translate it. And that has been much of the process, was we were trusting what we found. And we were trusting that because the subject was so idiosyncratic and unpinnable, like the whole thing is about what are the potholes. What one of the taglines we had for ourselves in the room was like, what are the potholes that a Black writer needs to go through and avoid while trying to write a play? Are there not obstructions that he puts on the table, but obstructions that come with being a Black writer or being perceived as a Black writer, whatever that means? And so they were just materializing in front of us as we were doing it. And instead of kind of trying to morph it into just dramatic dialogue, we would just kind of embrace it into the structure and try to respond to it in a more lateral way. And we did this throughout those 3 years. You know, we took tangents, but most of the time was like, okay, let's just do a scene about this, you know, and treat it as a live performance art thing, you know. Okay, and here come in balloons, and in this one we want to do microphones, and we weren't bound by the idea it all needs to tie in together, because what tied it together was it's being like an unsolvable knot. And I think that was what I really got excited at one point about, was the fact that we could do anything with it, because the dramaturgy was about making a show and writing the show at the same time. And the actual dramaturgy didn't lie within the writing, but was lying within the performance and in how the audience was receiving that performance. And so that's why the end of the show, Jungle Shit, didn't come until week two of rehearsals. We didn't know how it would end. And then, you know, we were doing previews and weren't even sure, you know, I think a lot of people were like, oh, should we really end it with Jungle Shit? Could it be something else? And then we did it in front of an audience and like, it cannot be anything else.
Jungle Shit. Urban Safari, Jungle Shit, Jungle Shit, Jungle Shit. Let's begin, Jungle Shit. Jungle Shit. Apparently, I wrote Jungle Shit, Jungle Shit. Is that a sin? Jungle Shit. Is it forbidden? Jungle Shit. Firstly, define Jungle Shit. Jungle Shit. Art depiction on the TV screen? Jungle Shit. Radio, news, magazine? Jungle Shit. Is that what they mean? Jungle Shit. Lock your window and your door? Jungle. We're coming through the ceiling and the floor? Jungle Shit. Shit, whole country shit? Jungle Shit. An African, an animal? Jungle. An Africanimal? A cannibal? Jungle. Africanimal, cannibal, satanical, jungle. Primitive, Neanderthal, jungle shit. Jungle, where we ought to be, jungle shit. Cracking nuts at the base of a tree, jungle shit. Banana eating, jungle shit. Chest beating, jungle shit. That what they mean by jungle shit? Jungle shit. Does urban youth come under it? Jungle shit. And I'm forbidden to write about it, jungle shit. They had a protective over it, jungle shit. It's like, it's some sacred shit, sacred shit. What, they mad that I lied? Jungle shit. Does it even matter? Jungle shit. That I told white lies? Jungle. White lies about black matters? Jungle. Don't you know black lives matter? Jungle shit. Man, if this shit was jungle shit, jungle shit. It won't be just any jungle shit, it'd be rainforest jungle shit, it'd be Jumanji jungle shit, it'd be Wakanda jungle shit. Jungle shit. But this ain't jungle shit. Jungle shit. This might be some theater shit. Theater shit. With a capital F. Theater shit. Because where I'm from, we say theater. Theater shit. If they don't like my theater shit, they can suck my big black theater.
The amount of times that we were doing workshops and then sharings and people were just sitting there with a puzzled look on their face.
Yeah.
Because there was no set, there was no music, you know, in these workshops, or barely something. There was no performance. Like Arinze was, poor thing, was reading from a lectern and, you know, he couldn't engage. And we needed to trust, and Madani, for instance, trusted that it would all come together. So I think as a director, my job in there was to go like, okay, we need to see beyond this step. We need to imagine it. And I think for everybody in the building, it wasn't clear until they sat through the first dress rehearsals and they went like, oh, holy shit, I can see it now. But they couldn't see it before. And that wasn't on them. It was just on the fact that when you're developing something that is so entangled with the way in which it is performed and in the way in which it is presented, and the fact that there are people in the room with you to consume it and to live through it, you can't mock it up.
Right.
A model box doesn't do anything. It does it for the artist because they know the end point of it.
Yeah.
Roughly. but for the layman, you know, and even for people working in theater who are not part of the process of imagining it, it's very difficult to. So I think we all need to be very thankful to Madani and the Bush for really going on the long haul and all in with this show. And if you had asked me during my 7 years at the Bush, which of our shows would have been the one that took us to the West End, I think nobody would have said it would have been Misty. And yet it was. So that was a real moment for everybody and something we were all very proud of as makers, as artists, because of what the play says and what the play looks like and how it feels and the people that come through the door to see it. We couldn't have imagined a better way to celebrate what we were all about during those 7 years.
Amazing.
I'm getting a bit sentimental now.
And Arinza, has it changed? Has Misty changed for you the way you think about making theater? How is it a stepping stone for the next phase of your career, do you think?
It's made me more courageous as a storyteller. It's made me trust my ideas more. It's made me not try to write with someone else's voice, to write with my voice. And it's also made me not afraid to be afraid, actually, to use fear as a compass, to use the information. There's a lot of information with fear. It's a whole thing that we try to avoid, right? We're taught to be quite selective about where we get our information, you know, when it comes to creating work. Everybody knows the feeling that you get when you come across an idea that you think you know is going to work. And like, it's kind of like that warm, fuzzy feeling like, the eureka, like, you know, I've got it and people are going to laugh. Oh, we know what it feels like to write a good joke, like, or to think of one even, you know, the feeling, you're like, there's dopamine, like once you think of it, before you even said it, it's like, you know, it's going to work because of 1 + 1 = 2. So, and with fear, again, it's the same thing. It's information. Unfortunately, I haven't been conditioned to enjoy that bit of information, but it can be so useful if you transmute it in the work. Omar spoke about the development of the sister character. We wouldn't have that character if it weren't for the fact that, I mean, and by the way, I didn't want to bring her in, like, in the beginning, you know. Omar said, like, because it's my sister, you know.
Yes, yes.
I respect my sister, you know. And she had kind of spoken about that. She said some things about the play. She questioned it. And around the kitchen table, my sister, me and her husband, Trevor, like, we all kind of spoke about the play because they had seen, he hadn't even seen it. You know, he wasn't there at the sharing, and yet he was still chipping in and saying, here's why you shouldn't put this play on. The discussion that we had, like, just kind of got my blood boiling, you know. I remember wanting to cry, you know, because I was like, oh man, I can't believe you guys didn't understand. And coming into the theater, going into the attic and exploring that with Omar and actually putting the discussion on the wall. You take it out of your mind. It's no longer identifying with your emotion and who you are. In fact, it's what people are saying. You know, it's just what someone has said about the thing you've written. That's it. It's on the wall. It's not attached to anybody. You know, it's no longer attached to my sister's face. It's like some other woman, like, you know, and then you can kind of like do whatever you want with it. It's about being open, welcoming to those things, like bring it into the room. So yeah, what has Misty done? You know, it's kind of changed the way that I look at work. And it's made me more courageous because of now I know that I can go into the fear. I can bring the ugly stuff in because of I feel like now that I've done some things with it, we can continue to, because if that was one thing, but there are other things in the play that I felt really nervous about discussing, you know, about saying it in the room. And yeah, now that we did it, it's done, you know. Like, I haven't been stoned for talking about those things.
This is an excellent way to finish, maybe, but I just want to return briefly to what you said about those sandy pages and how maybe they are finding their relevance now as a result of what's happening at the moment. Do you think that there is a future again for those sandy pages that you were trying to write in South Africa? Or?
Oh, 100%. What I'm realizing about my ideas, right? Man, what can I describe it as? You know, like there's this rock climbing thing. There's a wall, right, where you have like the sticks and you stick it into that hole, right? And then you stick the other one into the other hole. And this one, you know, you've stuck it into that hole. So now you use that as some leverage for your legs. Like, that feels like what I do is very often, like, as a writer. You know, some ideas that I have years ago, I think it's the thing that's going to get me up the mountain, right? Until I stick it in the hole and I realize that, oh no, actually I need my hand free. And so it's just the thing to get my leg up, you know. And with that idea, it's definitely one of those, you know. I needed to explore it in order to go to this other area, and then now I've come back to that stick and I can use it. I can actually really use it. And so those sandy pages came out and I'm developing something. You won't even recognize the inspiration behind it, but it's useful. This is why I don't throw any old drafts away or any rubbish plays or whatever, rubbish poems, a rubbish song, you know, that I've written. Like, I just keep everything because you just never know. But there's just going to come a time where you just think, oh, I know what to do with that now.
Great. Excellent. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Duška Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Bano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Duška Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.